This is Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. On Building Bridges, Bush signs the new pension bill, tolling the retirement bell in America.
While the new pension legislation is supposed to protect and strengthen private pension funds, many think it is part of a new three-sided attack on defined benefits pensions. In conjunction with the recent federal court's decision of 8-7 legalizing conversion of traditional plans to 401ks and the upcoming pension accounting rules bombshell that will further undermine all pensions, the new legislation will accelerate the collapse of defined benefit, mostly union pension plans, and will require a massive bailout of the pension benefit guarantee corporation. And with us is Jack Rasmus, author of The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to Bush. And we're going to try to find out what all of that means, because pension information is extremely complex and sometimes sounds a bit convoluted, but in many ways it's the difference between ourselves and being in work homes when our work life is finished.
Jack, before we talk about this new pension legislation, which is supposed to save pensions, but many people think is going to further destroy them, I think we really have to talk about how we got into this position to begin with. So if you want to talk a bit about how we got into the situation, the defunding of the pension system in the private sector to this point.
Well, the attack on defined benefit pensions, which are really pensions in which you have a guaranteed retirement payment per year of service, and companies have to honor that guarantee even if the investments in the pension funds don't turn out, unlike 401ks where they don't have to guarantee that. With a defined benefit plan, which are mostly union plans, they have to pay a certain level of benefits, and they've always chafed at that requirement of defined benefit plans, and since the early 80s, they've been doing their best to undermine those plans. In the early 1980s, for example, defined benefit plans, 80% of the workers in this country were covered by them, and there were like 114,000 such plans. Today, they've been chipping away at those plans and undermining them and closing them down, and today we only have 20% of the workforce covered in about 30,000 plans. Still 44 million workers and their families. But they've been undermining it for some time. What they've been offering as an alternative are 401k plans, which were virtually non-existent until Ronald Reagan came to office, but which today there's over 400,000 such 401k plans. The thing about 401k plans is that there's no guaranteed benefit payout, and there's no liability requirement on the part of the corporation. You know, there's no way of controlling those plans and no regulating those plans. There's virtually no regulation. So when you get a company like Enron or WorldCom, and they go bust, and workers don't even know about it, and they lose everything. But the process of undermining really began with Ronald Reagan. When he came into office, he had the IRS pass what was called Rule 8352, which meant, for the first time, companies could go in, and a plan might still be healthy and no problem, and they could simply close down that plan and take that money. It was considered, quote, management's money, even though the workers put all the contributions in. Another thing during Reagan's time was what was called reversions, a fancy word for just skimming off the surplus of a pension plan. You didn't have to close it all down, but you could go in, management could go in and just take off the surplus. You may have heard about United Airlines going bust last year, $10 billion worth of pension. Well, people aren't aware that United in 1987 went in and just skimmed off $286 million off the top of that plan, and then in the 90s didn't put the money back. So it's not strange that it went bust. It got so bad during the 1980s that Congress passed in 1990 what was called an excise tax on reversions, 50%. Well, the company's response to that was simply if they couldn't take money out, they wouldn't put money in. And throughout the 1990s, we had the situation where we had what were called contribution holidays on behalf of the of management. They simply didn't put the money in. To make it look better that the plans were still okay, they played fast and loose with two kinds of assumptions. Anyone who's negotiated pensions knows that you can make the pension fund look bigger than it is by playing with what's called rate of return assumptions, the interest rate, the investment of the money, or actually. actuarial assumptions, that is, how many young workers you have in the plan. The younger the workforce, you can make assumptions that the plan's healthier than it is. And also, if you make assumptions about higher interest rates, the plan will look better than it is. And during the Clinton years, companies could essentially say what they thought the rate of return was going to be, averaged over a 10-year period. Of course, it was a fantasy rate. It didn't really exist in reality, but they could do that. They were allowed to do that, and they did do that, and all the plans looked better during the 90s than they actually were. The recent congressional elections have exposed all this. So when you get the Bush recession in 2001, well, reality hits, and the interest rates drop to 1%. Young workers get laid off, and all of a sudden these plans are in big trouble. And, of course, steel workers, airline workers, auto supply and other workers, their plans started going bust. And the PBGC, which is the agency that pays out when these plans go bust, started developing huge deficits. Right now it's about $26 billion in immediate deficit. And the Wall Street Journal, for example, estimates that there's $450 billion in unfunded liabilities in defined benefit pension plans today. It's actually much more than that. It's probably $600 to $700 billion. And if you count the public employee pensions, it's probably over $1 trillion unfunded. Bush, instead of trying to do something about this during his first term, just allowed contribution holidays to go on and continue. For example, in 2004, when they almost passed an act, pension act, they Congress made a decision that they would allow companies not to put the money back in, even though these plans were unfunded, and it amounted to an $80 billion windfall for these companies not to refund their pension plans. So it kept getting worse and worse, and finally, here in 2006, they passed an act, and they call it the Pension Protection Act, but it's just the opposite. It's really designed to accelerate the demise of defined benefit pensions and what's left of them.
Yeah, Jack, when I saw the media coverage of Bush signing the bill, I wasn't sure whether this was a bill to protect the defined benefit pensions or a bill to promote 401ks. It seemed as if there was more in it to destroy the pensions, even from those articles, than to protect the pensions. So why don't we come up to a few days ago now, bring the story up to last week, when Bush signed the bill, and how that bill does the exact opposite of what it purports to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are five provisions in that act. And by the way, this is not just my view. There are even a number of congressmen who are saying that this act and this bill is going to lead to a collapse of the pension system in a couple of years, defined benefit system, and cause a trillion-dollar bailout, much like the savings and loans in the 1980s. But there are five provisions in this particular pension act that will promote the acceleration of the demise of defined benefit plans. First of all, they raise the contribution requirement per employee in a pension fund for companies. They raise it from roughly $19 to well over $30. But at the same time of raising that, they allow a 2-year to 7-year window for companies before they implement it, which means in that window, companies can just withdraw from the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation.
I thought that was mandatory.
No. They don't have to participate. They can withdraw from the pension PBGC, and many companies have been withdrawing over the years here, particularly those who didn't have pensions in trouble. They didn't want to fund those pensions that were in trouble. So if you don't have penalties on opting out, which they don't, well, then what you're really doing is saying, go ahead and get out.
I thought that the tax benefit of the contribution was the benefit, and that they would lose that.
Well, they will lose that except when they convert to cash balance plans. You see, that's where a cash balance plan comes in, a creature of the 1990s. If you get out of your defined benefit plan into a cash balance plan, which is kind of like a 401k plan, the company gets out of the liability, but it still keeps the tax advantages. That's the gimmick here, and that's why there's been a big move to cash balance plans in the last 10 years. The problem with cash balance plans, which are promoted in this act, are that workers don't get the full benefit they would have had under the defined benefit plan. They get 50 to 65%. And in particular, older workers really get hit hard. That's why older workers have been filing court actions against conversions to cash balance plans based on the Age Discrimination Act. In other words, they get hit hardest. And that's where this appellate court decision comes in, which was issued just 3 days after the passage, not coincidentally, of the Pension Act, which said that the 1,500 companies that had, and they're mostly Fortune 500 companies, that had converted already to cash balance plans can go ahead and do that. The main defendant was, for example, IBM, and IBM just pocketed $1.3 billion as a result of that ruling.
Well, let me figure this out. If they convert, they drop their pension fund, defined benefit fund.
Right, and they cash out.
They cash out of it. Then people have nothing from that, just the 401k, or do they have a lesser pension fund than they would have had? What about the people who already have the pension? Are they out the door also?
They can convert to a contribution plan at that point. And again, a contribution plan can be a 401k plan or it can be another kind of company-provided contribution plan, but it doesn't guarantee a certain level of benefits. That's the difference between a defined benefit plan and a defined contribution plan. And the advantage to the company is that it no longer has that liability of insuring a certain level of payment.
By the way, can we also just, because I don't want to run out of time on this, you were talking about the provisions, and there were five provisions
right.
of the bill.
Right.
I think it would be helpful to understand those as well. There's so much in this, and it's
okay.
so intricate, but at least to get some of that overview.
Okay, let me just go down the list real quick here. Actually, there's probably six. Raising the per-employee contribution without a penalty for dropping out is in the bill. And that will accelerate. The other thing is, instead of using a fixed interest rate to value the pension plans, like used to exist, the 30-year Treasury bill, now there's what's called a segmented interest rate, a mixed interest rate, which means that companies can pretty much, again, pick and choose the rates and manipulate them. Third is the provision in the Act that says cash balance plans going forward are okay. The court decision sort of absolved cash balance plans up to this point that were created, but now the Act says, go ahead, you know, go into cash balance plans, and combination with the other provisions is going to push them into cash balance plans. Then, of course, we have the two other provisions there strongly encouraging the formation of 401k plans, including automatic deductions to 401k plans, and then a little less clear, but I think is going to be significant, is the promoting of hedge funds. Very volatile, totally unregulated financial securities and institutions, which are now going to play fast and loose with pension funds. And they're very volatile. And if we hit a recession next year, which looks like it's coming, it's going to really undermine pensions even faster.
So does this leave every worker to kind of negotiate for his or herself? In other words, it would seem there's no incentive or mandate whatsoever for employers to offer pensions anymore, and it's strictly about individualism. Survive
well,
or don't on your ability to invest.
Well, that's what Bush calls the ownership society. In other words, the worker
yes.
has to own all the risk.
It sounds so nice.
Okay? And the 401k is in the pension realm an example of owning all the risk now, no guarantees. And in the healthcare sphere, it's called health savings accounts. The same thing. You own all the risk. Management will give you some money, a contribution, but you have to pay $2,000 deductibles. And even the privatization attempt of Social Security is another example of this so-called ownership society with the creation of private investment accounts. You see, corporate America sees these huge pools of public funds, be they pension funds or Social Security or health and welfare funds, and they want to get their hands on it. And corporate America is getting out of the pension and health care game that existed, you know, after World War II. We created pensions and health and welfare plans, and a lot of our standard of living was based on it. Well, they want to get out of that whole game. They want to abandon that game and put all of the risk on the back of the individual worker. And, you know, the risk is Enron, WorldCom, that kind of development tends to happen. But it's part of a bigger picture, too. You know, it's all part of covering my book, how now, as a result of policies of the last 20 years, $1 trillion a year has been transferred and is being transferred from 105 million non-supervisory production workers, the middle class, working class in this country, to the wealthiest 10% households. You know, and I quantify this in the book, how it's, you know, taxes and jobs and free trade and overtime, cutting overtime pay, lowering the minimum wage, shifting the cost of health care for those who still have it onto the backs of workers, and the pension transition here. It's all part of this grand strategy of shifting income from workers in the middle class to the wealthiest 10%. And the pension thing is just the latest example of this. It's sort of like the point of the corporate spear right now and what's happening, because if it goes bust, which even congressmen are predicting, there's about $1.9 trillion in the defined benefit pension plans covering 44 million workers and their families. But if it goes bust and they convert the whole thing and there's a bailout, you know, workers will get about half of it, which means, you know, about half of $1.9 trillion, and the rest of taxpayers is going to have to absorb.
Now, you're talking about if there's a bust of the Pension Guarantee Corporation,
right, exactly.
And about $750 billion, you're talking about, sort of like the savings and loan thing under Bush number one.
Exactly. That cost about $1 trillion as well. But they're setting up
the junior can't do less, can he?
For that. You know, the triple whammy is the Pension Act itself, which is going to push plans towards cash balance and to get out of the defined benefit realm. Second is this appellate court decision, which absolved all cash balance plans created. And the third, which I haven't mentioned, is the bombshell coming in September by the Financial Accounting Standards Board, which is going to rule that virtually most of the pensions in this country are totally underfunded, to the tune of about $1 billion per company on average, and they're going to have to put all the money back in. It's a triple whammy, and I don't think it's by coincidence that these three things are happening all at once.
I think you're going to have to elaborate just a little bit. We have about one more minute about this changing of assumptions on the investment that's coming up in September, what that means.
Okay, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, FASB, is a quasi-government agency which has been issuing rules here for public comment and will come on with a decision in September that pretty much says most of the pension plans have been underfunded for reasons I talked about during the 90s. They played all these assumptions games, and that includes public plans and government plans and private plans as well. And they're going to rule that you can't play these games anymore and you have to make up the difference. Well, when you make up the difference, you know, you have to put money back in. And either that, if you don't have the money, well, then you cash them out. You see, there's different elements here are working in concert with each other. And the cash out means you get about half, maybe, of what you would have got with your defined benefit plan. By the way, I should mention that while all this is happening and defined benefit plans are being eliminated, management over the last 10 years, senior CEOs and their senior staff have been setting up their own defined benefit plans and fully funding them separately, called SERPs, Supplemental Employment Retirement Plans. So they're taking care of themselves and funding about a third of their total compensation now is in SERPs. At the same time, they're undermining defined benefit plans for the rest of the workforce.
This is a terrifying clarion call for people to immerse themselves and understand these issues so that we don't have ripped away from us those benefits that we have fought for decades. And I really do want to encourage people to read The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to Bush. And that is put out by what publisher?
Kiklos Productions. You can find it in independent bookstores, on Amazon and Borders, or you can order it direct from Kiklos Productions at discount, and that's website, Kyklos, K-Y-K-L-O-S productions.com, all one word, kyklosproductions.com.
And we've been speaking with Jack Rasmus, who must join us again. Very complex, critical issue, affects hundreds of thousands of people, and it is about our future.
And it looks as if, as the Bush team goes into the last 2 years, they've got some unfinished business that they're going to try to do.
Well, I just might add on that, you know, last year they went after Social Security, then they put it on the back burner this year, but their new Secretary Treasurer Paulson is already putting up statements saying that after the elections they're going after Social Security again.
On that on that painful note, thank you for joining us, Jack Rasmus, author of The War at Home, The Corporate Offensive from Reagan to Bush. We'll definitely be speaking with you in the weeks and months to come.
Right,
thank
right.
you.
Okay, thank you very much.
I just want to let people know you're listening to Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Gathright certainly has the right idea. We are one world, and how long will it take before the governments of this planet understand that?
I pray every day for a change, and I know why. 'Cause we
Let's examine how Professor George W.'s economic theory is working today on Hightower Radio. When working families all across America are struggling, it's fitting for us to reflect on the profound insight of that prominent economic theorist, George W. Bush. In 2000, explaining his approach to economic policy, W. declared, "We ought to make the pie higher." What the professor was trying to express is the old theory that by baking a larger pie, everyone can get a bigger slice. But that theory ignores a special trick of economic pie-making that Bush baked right into his policy – greed. Yes, the pie is now larger, but Bush simply fattened the slices of the corporate powers and the rich, leaving the workaday majority of folks trying to get by on the same slim pickings they had before – or less. Today, corporate profits are surging, CEO pay is skyrocketing, purchases of luxury goods and oceanfront property is zooming, but the income of workers is not even keeping up with inflation. Well, now, wait a minute, say the Bushites. We've been creating thousands of new jobs, so see, trickle-down economics really does work. Hold it, greed breath. First, you've been losing jobs, too. In fact, Bush is the first president since Herbert Hoover to produce a net loss of jobs during his term. Second, and most important, the issue is not jobs. Think about it. Even slaves had jobs. The issue is income, wages, middle-class opportunities. Ask a waitress at any cafe or bar if she's aware that Bush has been creating new jobs, and she'll say, "Yeah, I know. I have three of them." In terms of buying power, average wages today are lower than what they were when Nixon was president. Under Professor Bush, America's economy is producing more low-wage service sector jobs while shipping out the manufacturing and high-tech jobs that offer our people middle-class wages and the opportunity for upward mobility. This is Jim Hightower saying, instead of trickle-down, America needs a grassroots policy of percolate-up economics.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Thank you.